Welcome back to the Roundtable. Splendor, Myth, and Vision, Nudes from the Prado is the current exhibition at the Clark in Williamstown, Massachusetts. The exhibition features 28 old master paintings from the Museo Nacional del Prado in Madrid by Titian, Peter Paul Rubens, and many others. The exhibition explores the role of the nude in European painting in the 16th and 17th centuries and the collecting and display practices of Spanish royalty. Kathleen Morris and Laura Yeager-Crisselt lead us on a radio tour of the exhibition this morning.
This is a show about the passion for collecting by the Spanish royal family, predominantly in the 16th and 17th centuries, and a passion for collecting paintings of the nude. But within that, it's about how, as Catholic kings, predominantly Philip II and Philip IV, negotiated their private and public roles. So while they loved mythological, biblical, and allegorical paintings by the most important artists across Europe at this period, Titian, Rubens, Guercino, they had to deal with the fact that they were representatives of the Catholic Church. They were the defenders of the Catholic faith in a moment of the Counter-Reformation and the Inquisition. And one of the ways in which they dealt with this private taste for the nude was how they displayed these paintings, and thus evolved the Sala Reservada, which was a private reserved space for their paintings of the nude. And this is a space, it wasn't one space in one palace, but a quite complicated set of rooms which moved around across Madrid in different palaces and outside of the city, and then really became a space of pleasure, also became a space of intellectual engagement for a very select audience of the kings, and continued all the way into the 19th century, because the Prado itself had a Sala Reservada in the 19th century for a period of about 10 years where only men of a certain age could come and look at paintings of the nude. So the show looks at the beginning of that tradition in the 16th century and how it evolved all the way through the 19th century.
If everyone had known about them or been able to find them or see them, would the paintings have been in danger?
Yes, and in fact, in the 18th century, you have a switch of dynasty from the Habsburg to the Bourbon dynasty, and those kings were not such great fans of the nude, and they wanted to destroy them, and they wanted to burn them all. And it was the efforts of court painters who saved them by putting them in a Sala Reservada, so they would be out of sight but protected. So in fact, the Sala Reservada becomes a site for pleasure, but also becomes a site of protection. And this is something that changes over time.
Okay, so how does this show come to the Clark?
Well, this show was a great opportunity for the Clark to partner with the Prado, which is one of the great museums of the world. And when we started the renovation of our museum building and started the construction of this building, we knew that we had opportunities that wouldn't come around again. So we approached the Prado and suggested doing an exchange project. And so, in fact, in 2010, the Clark sent all of our Renoir paintings to the Prado, which was a fantastically successful exhibition for them. And in exchange, we developed this exhibition, which is now being shown in Williamstown, great paintings from the Prado, kinds of things that they don't normally travel, the kinds of things that people in this region can't normally see.
Some of the paintings have never been in the U.S. before, right?
In fact, 24 of the 28 paintings in the exhibition have never been to the U.S. before. And another thing I wanted to point out about this opportunity is that we knew when we started the project of building the Clark Center, where the exhibition is being held, that we had new galleries with very high ceilings, very large spaces, where we could show very large paintings. And in fact, some of the paintings that are in the Prado exhibition would literally not have fit in the door of our old building.
So before we begin speaking about specific pieces, how is the size determined? How is that negotiated with the Prado, the size of the show? How many pieces you will get to borrow?
When we started talking about the exchange, we sent our Renoir collection, which was 32 paintings, and which was all of our Renoir paintings. But the idea was not that it had to be like a piece-for-piece swap. So we wanted to come up with the size of a show that would enable us to fill these galleries. And we also knew that the size of some of the paintings would mean that we needed fewer paintings to fill up the same amount of space. And so it really, the size of the show really evolved through the decisions that were made about the themes of the show, and then finding a checklist that really, you know, spoke to the kind of story that we were trying to tell in the show.
What should we look at first?
Fortuna by Peter Paul Rubens. And she is a full-length female nude, and she welcomes you into the first gallery, and she's on either side is surrounded by Philip II and Philip IV. And in a way, these two men aren't the main protagonists of the show, but so is Peter Paul Rubens, who is a Flemish artist that Philip IV was really the greatest patron of Rubens in the 17th century. And this is an extraordinary painting that was made for the king's hunting lodge, the Torre de la Parada outside of Madrid. And Fortuna is shown balancing pretty steadily, in fact, on a crystal ball in a stormy ocean, and there's lightning breaking in the distance, really tumultuous seas and waves, but she's fully confident, and she looks directly out at the viewer. And this is a tradition of the figure, allegorical figure of fortune, of the invariability of life, of luck, of chance, of fate. And Fortuna is usually shown either with a rudder and a sail, or a globe or a ball. So Rubens has combined these traditions that she's, you know, moving forth across the sea on this ball, but her drapery has become her sail. And you see her full body, this fleshy, robust Rubensian nude, which she was so admired for in Europe in this period and so admired by the Spanish court.
Is it known how artist and patron found each other?
It's a long relationship that Rubens had already come to the Spanish court as a young artist in 1603, and then he came again in 1628, which was a pivotal year. He came as a diplomat. He was working for the Habsburg court in Brussels at the time and working as a really European diplomat for the court. And that was probably one of the most important moments where he would have met Philip IV, would have seen the collection of Titian paintings that were collected by Philip's grandfather, Philip II, and would have really acquainted himself. And that was the beginning of that really important relationship between artist and patron.
What shall we look at next?
Very large painting by a number of Flemish artists. It's Sight and Smell, the allegory of sight and smell. And this is a wonderful image which introduces us to the ideas of collecting, of wealth, abundance, and knowledge, and in many ways encapsulates all of the themes of the show. We're looking at a palatial interior covered in art. Paintings line the corridor, they're stacked one behind the other in the foreground, antique sculptures line the walls, but in the immediate foreground, two female figures are seated and standing at a table, and they are the figures of Sight and Smell. Sight looks at herself in the mirror, Smell holds a bouquet of flowers, and the importance here of the senses, of sight, but also of understanding and sort of visual knowledge, that this is about art, but it's also about science. There's a telescope, an astrolabe, books on geometry and astronomy in the foreground. So this is a world which would have appealed and reflected the Spanish king's taste and passion for art and all things of the world.
You could look at this for hours and find something new to see. There's so much going on here.
There's an incredible amount of detail and a celebration of Flemish painting. This was a work of collaboration by at least four or five Flemish artists working in Antwerp. And all of the paintings that are depicted here are by Flemish artists or in reference to a type of Flemish painting. And it may have been a work which was sent from the Habsburg court in Brussels to Madrid as a gift, and would have certainly pleased Philip IV for what it represented.
As you were saying, you could look at this painting for hours and still see something new. But one of my favorite details of the painting is actually in the lower right, where you see a small painting that depicts a group of monkeys dressed up as humans. And it was a tradition, a kind of a satirical tradition, to show the follies of humanity by having these paintings of actually monkeys dressed up in human and doing human activities. But the spectators of this particular painting are a pair of monkeys themselves that are painted as putting their little paws on the painting and looking at it. And it's almost as if they're discussing it amongst each other. I just think it's the most charming detail.
We've moved into the second room of the show.
So the second room is filled with only four paintings, but four beautiful paintings painted by Venetian artists, artists working in Venice. And we wanted to create this very special small space to, in some ways, recapture the idea of an intimate viewing space that we know that the kings themselves created for themselves in their palaces. For these very erotic paintings, and paintings of beautiful naked women, of allegorical and mythological subject matters. And the centerpiece of this room is this beautiful painting by Titian of a reclining Venus with her son Cupid, the little baby with wings, and a musician who's playing an organ, but not really paying attention to his music, one could say, because he's turned around to look at her as she's laid out in all of her splendor before him. Titian was Philip II's great love as an artist. Philip II was a great collector of Titian and, in fact, purchased many things from Titian for his palaces. And he may have been the king that started the whole tradition of the Sala Reservata, because we know that Titian wrote to him about one of these very erotic, very risque paintings he was sending him and saying, I'm sending you another painting for your camerino, your little room. So this idea that the kings had their own special rooms in which they could put these very erotic and very sensuous paintings for their own pleasure goes back to the time of Philip II and his great patronage of this Venetian artist.
Splendor, Myth, and Vision, Nudes from the Prado, will be on view at the Clark in Williamstown, Massachusetts through October 10th. clarkart.edu for more information.
What do we have here?
So we're really excited to have three paintings that were made by Rubens and his workshop for Philip IV's Hunting Lodge, the Fortuna being one of them we just spoke about before. They're huge paintings. Two of them in the show, The Marriage of Peleus and Thetis, which was executed by one of Rubens's assistants, Jakob Jordaens, is about 10 feet wide. So when you have a sense of the scale of these large mythological paintings, complex narratives taken from antiquity, there were over 60 of them that were commissioned for the Hunting Lodge, which was a very private, privileged space of the king. So you have a sense that this was an extraordinary commission, and all of the works are sensual in the depiction of nude figures, in the subject matter. They're often violent, but these are subjects such as the marriage of Peleus and Thetis, which is the moment which begins, in fact, the very beginning of the story of the Trojan War. These are stories that the kings would have been familiar with. And while they provide visual pleasure of the figures that are depicted, and even in the way they're painted, in these broad, most sensuous brushstrokes, the stories themselves provided food for thought, contemplation, how to be a king, good examples, bad examples. And this is a story of Peleus and Thetis who are seated to the side. In fact, the right side of the composition, and they seem almost unimportant at this large wedding banquet which is taking place. And the one god or goddess who has not been invited to celebrate this wedding is Eris, the goddess of discord. And she, in her anger or frustration, throws a golden orb into the wedding feast, and it's inscribed to the fairest. And each of the goddesses around the table is making a gesture as if to presume she must be the fairest goddess of all. So Venus, who's seated in the foreground with Cupid hugging her knee, gestures self-reflexively back on herself as if to think, well, of course I must be the fairest goddess. And similar actions are taking place by other figures around the table. But it's in fact the shepherd Paris who will be tasked with deciding who gets the golden orb. And each goddess promises him something different. But Venus promises him the most beautiful woman in the world, Helen of Troy, and thus will start ultimately the Trojan War. But it's this kind of complex narrative and the stories that unravel that the king and his associates within the space of the hunting lodge, kind of ultimate sala reservata, would have provided probably hours of conversation.
So this large painting by Peter Paul Rubens, we are extremely excited to have here. It is actually a copy of a painting by Titian, of the same subject, the same size, that was in the Royal Collection at that time. And as Lara mentioned a few minutes ago, Rubens had gone to Spain on a diplomatic mission in 1628, and he evidently asked for permission to not only see all of the Titian paintings, and there were many, many of them, but to actually make his own copies of them. Now, at this time, he was a very famous artist. He was very assured in his own artistic abilities. So he's not trying to learn in the traditional sense of a young student trying to learn from a great master. He's actually sort of tackling the greatest master that he saw as his kind of predecessor on his own terms, making these one-on-one copies, but then trying to make them even better through his own application of paint, his own sense of color. And we know that these were very important to Rubens because he made many of these copies after Titian, and he took them all back with him when he left back to Flanders, and they stayed in his studio until his death. And another interesting sort of moment of acquisition for the kings of Spain is Philip IV, after Rubens' death, sends his agents to Flanders to buy as much as possible from Rubens' sale. So all of these things then come back to Spain, which shows how the esteem that Philip IV held Rubens in. So they could hang side by side with the originals. The original Titian of the Rape of Europa was actually later departed from the Spanish Royal Collections. It was given away as a diplomatic gift, and it now hangs in the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston. So at least for this short period of time, both of these paintings are in Massachusetts.
That's really cool.
Splendor, Myth, and Vision, Nudes from the Prado, will be on view at the Clark in Williamstown, Massachusetts through October 10th.
One of the next rooms in the exhibition is a more intimate space. And having come from the large room with all of the massive Rubens paintings, you return to something more akin to a sala reservada. These are Flemish cabinet paintings, which were works that were intended to be viewed in intimate spaces, to look at them very closely. And these are works which are typically landscapes by Flemish artists, a specialty of painters in the north during this period. And it's a wonderful world which opens up before your eyes. The delicacy with which they paint leaves and trees, animals sort of scurrying through the forest. And these are both imaginary but real, somehow at the same time. A work of by a landscape with Diana and Actaeon, by a collaboration of two Flemish artists, Hendrik de Klerk and Dennis van Alsloot, shows how the Flemish landscape became a setting for mythology. So what these artists have done is to take a scene from antiquity and put it outside of Brussels. So it becomes very relatable in a way to audiences. And this is also a sensual moment where the goddess Diana is bathing with her nymphs in secrecy, at least she's trying to, and they're all in various stages of undress, very erotic moment of portraying the body and showing it from different angles and positions. But the hunter Actaeon stumbles upon Diana while she's bathing, and she's a virtuous goddess, and she's not meant to be seen. And so as a result, Actaeon is turned into a stag, and he ultimately will be hunted by his own dog. So it's a real cautionary tale about looking. And in fact, the whole sala reservata is very much about what you can and can't see and restricted viewing and not. But there's this wonderful detail that Actaeon, who takes the pose of the Apollo Belvedere, a very famous antique sculpture at this time, sort of standing there very strong and tall and muscular, the antlers have already started to sprout from his head. So you have a sense of what's to come next. But these kind of intricate details and stories which are told in the Flemish landscape allowed viewers to explore slowly. And the three other paintings in this space, again, in a similar way, the world opens up with flowers and animals and seashells and everything, every creature you could possibly imagine, you could see here.
So the second half of the show is filled with a series of mostly large paintings that we refer to as history paintings, paintings of narrative subjects taken from the Bible, sometimes from ancient mythology, from history. And these were actually very important vehicles for painters of the time to display their ability to portray the human form, and the human form being one of the most important subject matters of art at this time. It's also, in some of these instances, some of these subject matters gave artists some kind of an excuse almost to deal with the nude human body. And so, for example, you see several biblical subjects that really lend themselves to portrayals of the nude. And in some ways, that kind of took a little bit of the stigma off of the paintings because they had a moralizing and a biblical subject. So we're standing now in front of one of the greatest paintings in the exhibition by the Italian painter Guercino from the early 17th century. And it shows a biblical subject from the Old Testament book of Daniel. It's actually a story that appears in the Catholic version of the book of Daniel, not the Protestant version. But it's the last chapter in the book of Daniel that shows a very modest and upright wife who is bathing in her own secluded garden. And she's completely naked. She has a little piece of drapery over her leg, but she's absorbed in her daily task of bathing, and she's being spied upon by two elders of the village. And they actually, as the story goes, they proposition her, and they threaten her that if she doesn't succumb to them, that they're going to accuse her of adultery. And in fact, she rebuffs their advances. They follow through with their threat. And it's Daniel who has to come to her rescue by suggesting that they both be cross-examined separately and their stories fall apart. But what I love about this painting, well, I love many things about this painting. I love the sculptural sense of her body, this very cool, beautiful nude that Guercino has created. The sense of light in the painting, so it's like a dawn or maybe a dusk. It's very, very beautiful light in the sky. And then these two very active but very creepy men who are spying on her, but also looking out at us, one of them, gesturing to us as if to caution us not to interrupt them or not to, you know, let her know that they're there. But in doing so, implicates us. We also become part of the story and part of the sort of conspiracy against this beautiful and innocent young woman. So it becomes a very moving depiction of the story that, again, is a beautiful subject matter. I mean, it's beautifully painted. The figures are quite beautiful. But it's also food for thought and a kind of a moralizing tale for people who were looking at it at the time.
We end the show with three paintings of the Christian saint, Saint Sebastian. And this representation of the male nude is something that had important value for viewers, for the religious, and particularly in the Counter-Reformation. But I think it's also nice to point out that while the majority of the show is female nudes, which were collected with the greatest passion by the Spanish kings, but there was also a place for the male nude. There are paintings by the Spanish artist Zubiran of Hercules, which is a really muscular, virile image of strength of the male body. And Saint Sebastian is portrayed nearly nude with a cloth draped around his waist. And these three representations by the Spanish artist Juan de Carreño, by the Italian artist Guido Reni, and then by the Spanish artist Ribera, who worked in Italy, you have three very different approaches to the male nude, to issues of spirituality and even realism and how they treat the body and sensuality. The Guido Reni is also one of the most important works of the show. It's a dark landscape that we look out, and it's almost difficult to see where he is, but Saint Sebastian is shown bound to a tree with one arrow piercing his side, and his body is this wonderful curve, S-curve, as his face looks upward towards the heavens. There's a very faint halo around his head, and the skin is incredibly smooth. Almost, you know, sort of ivory or porcelain-like. And even though in this moment of the first attempted martyrdom of Sebastian, there's not a trace of blood, and almost not so much pain, but a kind of religious ecstasy in a way. And this image was always viewed as very sensual. And in the 18th century, the drapery which covers his waist was in fact required by the queen to be extended a little bit further up to cover more of his midriff. So in this sense, these images in the 16th and 17th centuries had a very important religious function, and Saint Sebastian was particularly called upon in times of plague that the faithful would pray to him. But at the same time, it was a dangerous image because of the nudity of the saint himself as a male nude. An artist then would deal with this in different ways. While Reni approaches it in a very sensual way, Ribera is coming from a different tradition, and his Saint Sebastian, again, bound to a tree, but the arrows through his side, through his arm, blood trickles down. The skin is grittier, it's real, it's painted with coarser brushwork. It gives you a very different sense of this moment of martyrdom and approach to the male body. And even again with the Juan de Carreño Saint Sebastian, it's a full-length portrayal of the saint as a former Roman soldier. His armor is cast to the side, so you still have a sense of what he was before, but he too looks upwards towards the heavens. So there's a sense of being of this earth and the importance of the body itself, but also the importance of the spiritual.
Kathleen Morris is the Sylvia and Leonard Marks Director of Collections and Exhibitions and the Curator of Decorative Arts, and Laura Yeager-Crisselt is an Interim Curator of Paintings and Sculpture, both at the Clark Art Institute in Williamstown, Massachusetts. Splendor, Myth, and Vision, Nudes from the Prado will be on view at the Clark in Williamstown through October 10th. For more information, visit clarkart.edu. That link will be posted along with this audio tour at wamc.org/roundtable. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.